Osho, a bird on the wing, talks on Zen. Discourse number 4, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
Favorite Zen story is one I don't understand at all. It's about Joshua, who is in the monastery, and he turns to a new monk and he says, "Have I seen him here before?" And the monk says, "No, sir." He says, "Then have a cup of tea." Then he turns to another monk and he says, "Have I seen you here before?" And he says, "Yes, sir, of course you have." Then have a cup of tea. Later, the managing monk asked Joshua, "Why do you always reply to people with a cup of tea, whatever they reply?" And he said, "Manager, are you still here?" He says, "Yes, sir, of course I am." Then have a cup of tea.
The story is simple, but difficult to understand. And it is always so. More simple a thing, more difficult to understand. To understand, something complex is needed. To understand, you have to divide and analyze. A simple thing cannot be divided and analyzed. There is nothing to divide and analyze. The thing is so simple. The simplest always escapes understanding. That's why God cannot be understood. That is the most simple, the absolute simple thing possible. The world can be understood. It is very complex. More complex a thing, the mind can work on it. When it is simple, there is nothing to grind. The mind cannot work. Logicians say that simple qualities are indefinable. For example, if somebody asks you, "What is yellow?" It is such a simple quality, the color yellow. How you will define it? You will say, "Yellow is yellow." But the man will say, "That I know." But what is the definition of yellow? If you say, "Yellow is yellow," you are not defining. You are simply repeating the same thing again. It is a tautology. One of the most penetrating minds of this century, G. Moore, has written a book, Principia Ethica. The whole book consists in a very persistent effort to define what is good. Making efforts from all the directions in 200-300 pages, and 200-300 pages of G. Moore is worth 3,000 pages of anybody else. He comes to the conclusion that good is indefinable. It cannot be defined. It is such a simple quality. When something is complex, there are many things in it. You can define one thing by another that is present there. If in a room 2 persons are there, I and you, and you ask me, "Who are you?" I can at least say, "I am not you." This will become the definition, indication. But if I am alone in the room, And I ask the question to myself, who am I? The question resounds, but there is no answer how to define it. That's why God has been missed. Intellect denies it. Reason says no. God is the simplest denominator in existence, the most simple and the most basic. The mind stops. There is no other than God, so how to define it? He is alone in the room. That's why religions have been trying to divide. Then definition is possible. So they say this world is not that. God is not the world. God is not matter. God is not body. God is not desire. These are ways to define. So you have to put something against. Then a boundary can be drawn. How you draw a boundary if there is no neighbor? Where you place the fence of your house if there is no neighborhood? If there is no one besides you, how can you fence your house? Your house boundary consists in the presence of the neighbor, and God is alone. There is no neighbor to him. Where he begins, where he ends, nowhere. And how to define? Just to define, devil is created. God is not the devil. At least this much can be said. You may not be able to say what God is, but you can say what he is not. God is not the world. I was just reading one Christian theologian's book. He says God is everything except evil, but that too is enough to define. This much will draw a boundary, except evil. But he is not aware, if God is everything, then from where this evil comes? It must be coming from everything. Otherwise there is some another source of existence except God. And that other source of existence becomes equivalent to God. And then evil can never be destroyed. It has its own source of existence. The evil is not dependent on God. How can God destroy it? And God will not destroy, because once evil is destroyed, God cannot be defined. He needs devil to be always there, just around him to define him. Saints need sinners, otherwise they will not be there. How you will know who is a saint? So every saint needs sinners around him. Those sinners make the boundary. A simple thing means alone. The first thing to be understood is complex things can be understood, simple things not. This Joseph's story is very simple, so simple it escapes. You try to grip, you try to grasp, it escapes. It is so simple. The mind cannot work on it. Try to feel the story. I will not say try to understand, because you cannot understand it. Try to feel the story. Many things are hidden if you try to feel. If you try to understand, nothing is there. The whole anecdote is absurd. Joseph sees one monk and asks, "Have I seen you before?" The man says, "No, sir. There is no possibility. I have come for the first time. I am a stranger. You must not have seen me before." Joseph says, "Okay, then have a cup of tea." Then he asks another monk, "Have I seen you before?" The monk says, "Yes, sir. You must have seen. I have been always here. I am not a stranger." The other must have been a disciple of Joseph. And Joseph says, "Yes, okay. Then have a cup of tea." The manager of the monastery became puzzled, because two different answers were needed. Because two different persons responding in different ways, but Joshua responds in the similar way to the stranger and to the friend, to one who has come for the first time and to one who has been here always. To the unknown and to the known, Joshua responds in the same way. He makes no distinction. Not at all. He doesn't say, "So you are a stranger, welcome, have a cup of tea." He doesn't say to the other, "So you have been always here, so there is no need for a cup of tea," or "You have been always here, so no need to respond." Familiarity creates boredom. You never receive the familiar. Your wife, you never look at her. She has been with you for many, many years. You have completely forgotten that she exists. What is the face of your wife? Have you looked at her recently? You may have completely forgotten. And if you close your eyes and meditate and remember, you may remember the face that you looked for the first time. But your wife has been a flux, a river, constantly changing. The face has changed, now she has become old. Now the river has been flowing and flowing. New banks have been reached, the body has changed. Have you looked at her recently? She is so familiar, there is no need to look. We look at something which is unfamiliar. We look at something which strikes you as strange. They say familiarity breeds contempt. It breeds boredom. I have heard one anecdote. Two businessmen, very rich, were relaxing on the Miami beach, lying down, taking a sun bath. And the one said, "I can never understand what people say, what people see in Elizabeth Taylor, the actress. I don't understand what people see, why they become so mad. What is there? You take her eyes away, you take her hairs away, you take her lips away, you take her figure, and what is left? What have you got?" The other man grunted, became sad, and replied, "My wife. That is left." That's what has become of your wife, of your husband. Nothing is left. Familiarity. Everything has disappeared. Your wife is a ghost. Your husband is a ghost. With no figure, with no lips, with no eyes. Just an ugly phenomenon. This has not been always so. You had fallen in love with this woman once, but that woman is no more there. You don't look at her at all. Really, husbands and wives avoid looking at each other. I have been staying in many families and watching. Husbands and wives are wired to look at each other. They have created many games how to avoid. They are always uneasy when they are left alone. So always a guest is welcome, because both can look at the guest and avoid each other. This Josu seems to be absolutely different, behaving in the same way with an stranger and a friend. The other says, I have been always here, sir. You know me well. And Josu says, then have a cup of tea. The manager couldn't understand. Managers are always stupid. To manage, a stupid mind is needed. And a manager can never be deeply meditative. Difficult. He has to be mathematical, calculating. He has to see the world and arrange accordingly. He became disturbed. What is this? What is happening? This looks illogical. It's okay to offer a cup of tea for a stranger, but to this disciple who has always been here. So he asked, why you respond in the same way to different persons, to different answers? And Josu called loudly, manager, are you here? And the manager says, yes, sir, I am here, of course. And he said, then have a cup of tea. This asking loudly, manager, are you here? Is calling his presence, his awareness. And awareness is always new. It is always a stranger, the unknown. The body becomes familiar, not the soul, never. You may know the body of your wife, you will never know the unknown person hidden, never. That cannot be known. You can love. It is a mystery. You cannot explain it. When Josu called manager, are you here? Suddenly the manager became aware. He forgot that he is a manager. He forgot that he is a body. He responded from his heart. He said, yes, sir. And this asking loudly was so sudden, it was just like a shock. And it was futile. That's why he says, of course, I am here. You need not ask me. The question is irrelevant. Suddenly the past, the old, the mind drops. The manager is no more there. Simply a consciousness responding. Consciousness is always new. Constantly new. It is always being born. It is never old. And then Josu said, then have a cup of tea. So the first thing to be felt is, for Josu, everything is new, strange, mysterious. The known, the unknown, the familiar, the unfamiliar, it makes no difference. If you come to this garden every day, by and by you will stop looking at trees, because you think you have already looked at them, you know. By and by you will stop listening to the birds. They will be there singing, but you will not listen. You have become familiar. The eyes are closed, the ears are closed. But if Josu comes in this garden, he may be coming every day for many, many lives. But whenever Josu comes, he will hear the words. He will look at the trees, because everything, every moment is new. And this is what awareness means. For awareness, everything is constantly new. Nothing is old. Nothing can be old because everything is being created every moment. It is a continuous flow of creativity. Awareness never carries memory as a burden. So the first thing, a meditative mind always lives in the new, in the fresh. The whole existence is just born, as fresh as a dewdrop, as fresh as a leaf coming out in spring. Just like the eyes of a newly born babe. Everything fresh, clear, with no dust on it. The first thing to be felt. If you look at the world and you feel everything is old, that shows that you are not meditative. Really, when you feel everything is old, that shows that you have an old mind, a rotten mind. If your mind is fresh, the world is fresh. The world is not the question. The mirror. If the dust is there, then the world is old. If there is no dust, how the world can be old? And if things get old, you will live in boredom. Everybody lives in boredom. Everybody is bored to death. Look at people's faces, carrying their life as a burden, bored, no meaning. Seems to be everything just a nightmare, a very cruel joke, somebody playing a trick, torturing. Life is not a celebration, it cannot be. With a mind burdened with memory, life cannot be a celebration. Even if you laugh, your laughter carries boredom. Look at people laughing. They laugh with an effort. Their laugh may be just to be mannerly. Their laughter may be just an etiquette. I have heard one dignitary went to Africa to visit a community, a very old primitive community of aboriginals. He gave a long lecture. He told a very long anecdote, almost for half an hour. The anecdote continued. And then the interpreter stood. And he spoke only four words. And the primitives laughed heartily. The dignitary was puzzled because he has been telling it for half an hour. How it can be translated in four words? It seems impossible, and people have understood and they are laughing, a belly laugh. So he asked, puzzled, he asked the interpreter, "You have done a miracle. You have spoken only four words. I don't know what you have said, but how you can translate my so long a story?" The interpreter said, "A story too long. So I say, he says a joke, laugh." What type of laughter will come out? Just mannerly, etiquette. This man has been laboring for half an hour. Look at people's laughter. It is a mental thing. They are making an effort. Their laughter is false. It is painted. It is just on the lips. It is an exercise of the face. It is not coming from their being, from the source, from the belly. It is not coming. It is a created thing. It is obvious. We will be bored. And whatsoever we do will come out of this boredom and will create more boredom. You cannot celebrate. Celebration is possible only when existence is a continuous newness, when existence is always young, when nothing goes old, when nothing really dies, because everything is constantly reborn. Then it becomes a dance. Then it is an inner music flowing. Whether you play on an instrument or not, that is not the point. The music is flowing. I have heard it happened in Ajmer. You must have heard about one Sufi mystic whose dargah is in Ajmer, Muhyiddin Chisti. He was a great mystic, one of the greatest ever born. And he was a musician. And that is against Islam, because music is prohibited. And he played on sitar and on other instruments, and he was a great musician. He enjoyed really 5 times every day when a Mohammedan is required to pray the 5 ritual prayers. He won't pray. He will simply play on his instrument. That was his prayer. This was absolutely anti-religious. But nobody could say anything to Chisti. Many times people came to say to him, and he will start singing. And the song was so beautiful, they will forget completely for what they had come. And he will start playing on his instrument. And it was so prayerful that even scholars and pandits and maulvis who had come to object, they couldn't object, they forgot. They will remember back. When they are at home back, they will remember for what they had gone. Chisti's fame spread all over the world. From every part of the world, people started coming. One man, he himself a great mystic, Jilani, came from Baghdad. Just look at Chisti. When Chisti heard that Jilani has come, he felt it will not be good now to play on my instruments, just to pay respect to Jilani, because he is such an orthodox Mohammedan that it will not be a good welcome. He may feel hurt. So for that day only in his whole life, he will not play, he will not sing. From the morning he waited. In the afternoon Jilani came. He has hidden his instruments. When Jilani came and they both sat in silence, the instruments started music. The whole room was filled. Chisti became very much puzzled what to do. And he has hidden them. And such music he has never known before. Jilani laughed and he said, rules are not for you. You need not hide them. Rules are for ordinary people. Rules are not for you. You should not hide them. And how can you hide your soul? Your hands may not play. You may not sing from the throat, but your whole being is musical. And this whole room is filled with so much music, with so much vibrations, that now the whole room is playing by itself. When your mind is fresh, the whole existence becomes a melody. When you are fresh, freshness is everywhere. The whole existence responds. When you are young, not burdened by memory, everything is young and new and strange. This Josu is wonderful. This has to be felt deeply. Then you will be able to understand. But that understanding will be more like a feeling rather than understanding, not mental but from the heart. Many more dimensions are hidden in this story. Another dimension is that when you come to an enlightened person, whatsoever you say makes no difference, his response will be the same. Your questions, your answers are not meaningful, not relevant. His response will be the same to all the three. He responded in the same way, because an enlightened person remains the same. No situation changes him. Situation is not relevant. You are changed by the situation. You are completely changed. You are manipulated by the situation. Meeting a person who is a stranger, you behave differently. You are more tense. Trying to judge the situation. What type of man is this? Dangerous, not dangerous, will prove friendly or not. You look with fear. That's why with strangers you feel an uneasiness. If you are traveling in a train, the first thing you will see, passengers ask each other what they do, what is their religion, where they are going. What is the need of these questions? These questions are meaningful because then they can be at ease. If you are also a Hindu and they are Hindu, they can relax. The man is not very strange. But if you say that I am a Mohammedan, then the Hindu becomes tense. Then some danger is there. Some stranger is there. He will make a little space between you and him. He cannot be at ease, he cannot relax. Or even he may change his seat. But even a Mohammedan is religious. If you say, I am an atheist, I am not religious at all, I don't belong to any religion, then you are even more a stranger. Atheist, then he will feel that just sitting by your side, he will become impure. You are like a disease. He will avoid you. People start asking questions. Not that they are very much curious about you. No. They just want to judge the situation, whether they can relax, whether they are in a familiar atmosphere, or something strange is there. They are on their safeguard. This is their inquiry for safety. Your face changes continuously. If you see a stranger, you have a different face. If you see a friend, immediately the face changes. If your servant is there, you have a different face. If your master is there, you have a different face. You continuously change your mask because you depend on the situation. You don't have a soul. You are not integrated. Things around you change you. That is not the case with a Joseph. With a Joseph, totally different is the case. He changes his surroundings. He is not changed by his surroundings. Whatsoever happens around is irrelevant. His face remains the same. There is no need to change the mask. It is reported that once a governor came to see Joseph. Of course, he was a great politician, powerful man, a governor. So he wrote on a paper that I have come to see. He wrote his name and then governor of this and this state. He must have knowingly, unknowingly wanted to influence Joseph. Joseph looked at the paper, threw it, and said to the man who has brought the message, that tell that I don't want to see this fellow at all. Throw him out. The man came and said that Joseph has said, throw him out, and he has thrown your paper. And he says, I don't want to see this fellow. The governor understood. He wrote again a paper, just his name, and said, I would like to see you. The paper reached Joseph's. So this is the fellow. Bring him in. The governor came in and he asked, but why you behaved in such a strange way? You told that throw this man. Joseph said, faces are not allowed here. Governor is a face, a mask. I recognize you very well, but I don't recognize masks. And if you have come with a mask, you are not allowed. Now, it is okay. I know you very well. But I don't know any governor. And when next time you come, leave the governor behind. Leave it at your house. Don't bring it with you. We almost continuously using faces. Immediately we change. If we see changes in the situation, we change immediately. As if we have got no integrated soul, no crystallized soul. For Joseph, everything is the same. This stranger, this friend, a disciple, this manager. But his response, have a cup of tea. He remains the same inside. And why have a cup of tea? This is a very symbolic thing for Zen masters. Tea was discovered by Zen masters. And tea is not an ordinary thing for them. In every Zen monastery they have a tea. room is special, just like a temple. So you will not be able to follow, because tea is a very religious thing for a Zen master or a Zen monastery. Tea is just like prayer. It was discovered by them in India. If you see a sannyasin drinking tea, you will feel that he is not a good man. Gandhi will not allow in his ashram anybody to take tea. Tea was prohibited. It is a sin. Nobody was allowed to take tea. If Gandhi read this story, he would be hurt. An enlightened person, Josu, asking people, inviting people to have tea. But Zen has a different attitude about tea. The very name comes from a Chinese monastery, Ta. There, for the first time, they discovered. And they found that tea helps meditation, because tea makes you more alert. It gives you a certain awareness. That's why if you take tea, it will be difficult for you to go to sleep immediately. So they found tea helps awareness, alertness. So in a Zen monastery, tea is part of meditation, one thing. And what Josu can offer more than awareness? So when he says, have a cup of tea, he's saying, have a cup of awareness. Tea is very symbolic for them. And he says, have a cup of awareness. And that's all that an enlightened can do. If you come to me, what can I offer to you? I have nothing else than a cup of tea. Familiar, unfamiliar, friend or a stranger, or even the manager who has been always there managing his monastery. Have a cup of tea. That's all a Buddha can offer to anybody. But there is nothing more valuable than that. In Zen monasteries, they have a tea room. It is like a temple, the most sacred place. You cannot enter with your shoes, because it is a tea room. You cannot enter without taking a bath, because it is a tea room. And tea means awareness. And the ritual is just like prayer. When people enter in a tea room, they take bath, they leave their shoes out, they put on fresh clothes, they become silent. When they enter the room, no talk is allowed. They become silent. They sit on the floor in a meditative posture. And then the hostess or the host prepares tea. Everybody is silent. And the tea starts boiling. And everybody has to listen to it. The sound, the kettles, creating a music. Everybody has to listen to it. The drinking has started. The tea is not ready. And if you ask Zen people, they will say tea is not something that you pour with unawareness and drink like any other drink. It is not a drink. It is meditation. It is prayer. So they listen to the kettle creating a melody. In that listening, they become more silent, more alert. Then cups are put before them. They touch. Those cups are not ordinary. Every monastery has its own unique cups. They prepare their own cups. Even if they purchase from the market, first they break them, then glue them again. So the cup becomes special. You cannot find any replica of it anywhere else. When everybody touches the cup, feels the cup. Cup means the body. If tea means awareness, then cup means the body. And if you have to be alert, you have to be alert from the very roots of the body. Touching, they are alert, meditating. Then the tea is poured, the aroma comes, they smell. And this takes a long time, 1 hour, 2 hours. So it is not just within a minute you have drunk the tea, thrown the cup and gone away. No, it is a long process, it's slow. So you become aware of each step. And then the drink. The taste, the heat, and everything has to be done in a very alert mindfulness. That's why master gives the tea to the disciple. A master pouring tea in your cup, you will be more alert and aware. A servant pouring tea in your cup, you can simply forget him. When Joseph pours tea in your cup, if I come and pour tea in your cup, your mind will stop. You will be silent. Something special is happening, something sacred. Tea becomes a meditation. And Joseph says, have a cup of tea to all these three. Tea is just an excuse. Joseph will give them more awareness. And awareness comes through sensitivity. You have to be more sensitive. Whatsoever you do. So even a tribal thing like tea, can you find anything more tribal than tea? Can you find anything more mean, ordinary, than tea? No, you cannot find. And Zen monks and masters have raised this most ordinary thing into the most extraordinary. They have bridged this and that, as if tea and God become one. And unless tea becomes divine, you will not be divine. Because the least has to be raised to the most. The ordinary has to be raised to the extraordinary. The earth has to be made heaven. They have to be bridged. No gap should be left. If you go to a Zen monastery and you see a master drinking tea with an Indian mind, you will feel very much disturbed. What type of man is this drinking tea? Can you conceive Buddha under the Bodhi tree drinking tea? You cannot conceive. Inconceivable. The Indian mind has been talking about non-duality but has created much duality. You have been listening to Advaita, the unity, the one. But whatsoever you have done, you have created two. And you have created such a gap between the two that they look unbridgeable. Because of this, Shankara has to talk about Maya and illusion. You have created such a gap between this world and that world, they cannot be bridged, so what to do? So Shankara says, this world is illusory, you need not bridge. This world is not. That's the only way. How to come to one? You have to deny the other so completely. But denial won't help. Even if you say this world is illusory, it is there. And why you insist so much it is illusory if it is really not there? What is the problem? Why Shankara goes his whole life teaching people that this world is illusory? Nobody bothers if it is illusory. If Shankara knows it is illusory, then why bother about it? Seems there some problem is there. It cannot be bridged, so only way is to drop it completely from consciousness, say it is not there. So only one remains. We have only one way to come to the one, to deny the other. Zen has another way to bridge. And I think that is more beautiful, to bridge. No need to deny the other, and you cannot deny. Even in denial you will assert. If I say this world doesn't exist, I have to indicate to this world, which is nowhere. So what you are indicating? What you are pointing with your finger if there is nothing? Then you are foolish. This world exists. And if I say it is illusory, it is only an interpretation. And if this world is illusory, that cannot be real. Because from this, that has to be achieved. If this world is illusory, then your Brahma cannot be real. If the creation is illusory, how can be the creator real? Because the creation comes from the creator. If Ganges is illusory, how can the Gangotri be real? If I am illusory, then my parents are bound to be illusory. Because only out of dream a dream is born. If they are real, then their child must be real. Zen says both are real, but both are not, to bridge them. So tea becomes prayer. Most profane thing becomes most sacred. It is a symbol. And Zen says, if your ordinary life becomes extraordinary, only then you are spiritual. Otherwise, you are not spiritual. In the ordinariness, the extraordinary has to be found. In the familiar, the strange. In the known, the unknown. In the near, the far. In this, that. So Joseph says, come and have a cup of tea. One more dimension is there in the story. And the dimension is of welcome. Everybody is welcome. Who you are is not relevant. You are welcome. At the gate of an enlightened master, at the gate of a Josu or Buddha, everybody is enlightened, everybody is welcome. The door is in a sense open. Come in and have a cup of tea. What does this mean? Come in and have a cup of tea. Josu is saying, come in and relax. If you go to other so-called masters, so-called monks and sannyasis, you will become more tense. You cannot relax. Go to a sannyasi, you become more tense. You become more afraid. And he creates guilt. He will look at you with condemnatory eyes. The very way he will look at you, he will say, you are a sinner. And he will start condemning, this is wrong, that is wrong, leave this, leave that. This is not the way of a really enlightened person. He will make you feel relaxed. There is a Chinese saying that if you reach to a really great man, you will feel relaxed with him. If you reach to a false great man, he will create tension within you. He will make knowingly, unknowingly, every effort that you are low, a sinner, guilty. He is high, above, transcendental. A Buddha will help you to relax, because only in your deep relaxation you will also become a Buddha. There is no other way. Have a cup of tea, Josu says, come and relax with me. The tea is symbolic. Relax. And if you are drinking tea with a Buddha, you immediately will feel that we are not aligned, not strangers. And Buddha pouring tea in your pot. Buddha has come down to you. Buddha has come to this. He has brought that to this. Christians, Jews cannot conceive, Mohammedans cannot conceive. If you knock at the gate of heaven, can you conceive God coming in and telling you, come, have a cup of tea? Looks so profane. God will be sitting on his throne, looking at you with his thousand eyes, looking at every nook and corner of your being, how many sins you have committed. Judgment will be there. This Josu is non-judgmentary. He does not judge you, he simply accepts. Whatsoever you say, he accepts and says, come and relax with me. Relaxation is the point. And if you can relax with an enlightened person, his enlightenment will start penetrating you. Because when you are relaxed, you become porous. When you are tense, you are closed. When you relax, he will enter. When you are relaxed, comfortable, drinking tea, Josu is doing something then. He cannot enter through your mind, but he can enter through your heart. Asking you to have a cup of tea is making you relaxed, friendly, bringing you nearer, closer. And you remember, whenever you are taking food, drinking something with someone, you become very intimate. Food and sex are only two intimacies. In sex you are intimate, in food you are intimate. And food is more basic an intimacy than sex. Because a child is born, the first thing he will receive from the mother will be food. Sex will come later on when he will become mature sexually. 14, 15 years afterwards. The first thing you have received in this world is food. And that food was a drink. So the first intimacy known in this world is between a mother and a child. Joshua is saying, come, have a cup of tea. Let me become your mother. Let me give you a drink. And a master is a mother. I insist that a master is a mother, a master is not a father. And Christians are wrong when they call their priest father. Because father is a very unnatural thing, a societal phenomenon. Father doesn't exist anywhere in nature except human society. It is a created thing, a cultured thing. Mother is natural. It exists without any culture, education, society. It is there in nature. Even trees have mothers. And you may not have heard that not only your mother gives you life, even a tree. They have been experimenting in England. There is a special lab, Dilawar. They have been experimenting about plants. And they have come to discover a very mysterious phenomenon. If a seed is thrown in the soil and the mother is near, from where the seed has been taken, it sprouts sooner. If the mother is not near, it takes longer time. And if the mother has been destroyed, cut, then it takes very long time for the seed to sprout. The presence of the mother, even for a seed, is helpful. A master is a mother. He is not a father. With father you are related only intellectually. With mother your relation is total. You have been part of your mother. You belong to him totally. The same is the case with a master in a reverse order. You have come out of mother, you will go in the master. It is a returning back to the source. So Zen masters always invite you for a drink. They are saying in a symbolic way, come and become a child to me. Let me become your mother. Let me become your second womb. Enter me. I will give you a rebirth. Food is intimacy. And it is so deep rooted in you that your whole life is affected by it. Men all over the world, different societies, different cultures, but goes on thinking of women's breasts, paintings, sculpture, films, novels, whatsoever. The breast remains the central point. Why so much attraction for the breast? That has been the first intimacy with the world. You came to know existence through it. The breast was the first touch of the world. For the first time you came near to existence. For the first time you knew the other from the breast. That's why so much attraction for breast. You cannot be attracted towards a woman who has no breasts, flat breasts, difficult, because you cannot feel the mother there. So even an ugly woman becomes attractive if she has beautiful breasts, as if breasts is the point, the central thing in the being. And what is breast? Breast is food. steps comes later, foot comes first. Zosu calling all the three to come and have a cup of tea, calling them to an intimacy. Friends eat together. If you see a stranger coming near you when you are eating, you will feel uncomfortable. Strangers feel uncomfortable if they eat together. That's why in a hotel, in a restaurant, things have gone very wrong. Because you are eating with strangers, the food becomes poisonous. You are so strained and tense. It is not a family. You are not relaxed. Food prepared by someone who loves you has a different quality altogether. Even the chemical quality changes. And psychologists say when your wife is angry, don't allow her to prepare food. It becomes poisonous. But it is difficult because the wife is almost always angry. And psychologists say when you are eating and if your wife starts creating trouble, talking, argumenting, stop. But then you will die. Because the wife always, almost, when you are eating, creates trouble. This is a very non-loving world. If a wife knows, if she has a small understanding, the worst time to create any conflict is while the husband is taking food. Because when he is strained, tense, not relaxed, food becomes poisonous. It will take longer time to digest it. Psychologists say double time will be needed to digest the food. And the whole body suffers. Food is intimacy. It is love. Zen masters always invite for the tea. They will take you in the tea room and give you tea. They are giving you food, drink. They are telling you, become intimate. Don't stand so far away. Come nearer. Feel homely. These are the dimensions, but dimensions of feeling. You cannot understand, but you can feel. And feeling is a higher understanding. Love is a higher knowing. And heart is the supreme most center of knowledge, not the mind. Mind is just secondary, workable, utilitarian. You can know the surface through the mind. You can never know the center. But you have forgotten the heart completely, as if it has become a nothingness. You don't know anything about it. And if I talk about the heart, you think about the lungs, not about the heart. Lungs are not the heart. Lungs is just the body of the heart. Heart is hidden in the lungs, somewhere deep down. And it is not a physical thing. So if you go to a physician, he will say there is no heart, only lungs. And he is right as far as he knows. Because if you dissect, no heart is found, only lungs. Just as in your body, the soul is hidden, in your lungs the heart is hidden. Heart has its own ways of knowing. Josu can be understood only through the heart. If you try to understand through the intellect, it is possible you may misunderstand. But understanding is not possible, that much is certain. Anything more?
There's a question here from a friend that has trouble being relaxed with a Zen master. He says, you have said that you have an abundance of compassion for us. I feel that at the same time I want to be close to you, I want to run as far away from you as I can. I don't understand this fear, as I'm not aware of a feeling like this about anyone else.
It's natural. It is not something exceptional. Whenever you have a feeling to be closer to a man like me, the fear will come. Because to be close to me means to be dead. To be close to me means losing yourself. The same fear that grips a river when it comes to the ocean. The banks will be last, the river will be last, and every river tries to go back, but there is no way. If you feel a deep urge to come closer to me, there is no way now to escape. You may try, but you will be a failure. Others have tried, others will go on trying. If you have a deep urge to come closer to me, you will have to come. Only you can delay it. By escaping, struggling, you can delay it. You can postpone it, that's all. Because the deep urge is coming from your very being. Fear is only in the mind. The urge is coming from the deepest core of your being to be closer. But the fear comes in the mind because closeness means death. To be close to a master is death. Your ego will have to go. The ego thinks, it starts thinking that I must escape before something happens. Before I am lost, I must escape. The ego will continuously tell you to escape. The ego will find rationalizations. It will find faults in me just to help you escape. It will convince you in every way that this is a wrong man. Love is death-like. And no love is so death-like as loving a master. If you love a woman, you can dominate her. That's why lovers go on playing politics with each other, dominating, possessing. The fear is there, if you don't dominate, you will be lost and the other will dominate. So they continuously fight. Husbands and wives, lovers go on fighting. The fight is for existence, to survive. The fear is there, I may be lost in the other. But when you come to a master, you cannot dominate him. You cannot fight with him. So fear is deeper because of that. Because you cannot create any politics. Either you have to escape or march. No other alternative is there. If you escape, from your very deep source of being you hear, you are doing wrong. If you escape, you will have to come back. If you come closer, the mind says, where are you going? If you go more closer, you may be burnt. And it is right, the ego is right. The flame is there, if you come more closer, you will be burnt. Conflict is created, inner tense and anguish is created. You can delay, that's all. Sooner or later you will have to merge. No river can escape the ocean. Once you have come closer, you have come. There is no way to go back. No way exists for going back. You are here, you have traveled long. Not in physical space only, but in the inner space also you have traveled long. Many, many lives. You have been traveling towards this point. You desired it, and now when the point has come nearer, you become afraid. You feel that a merger. The fear is natural. Understand it. Don't let it overpower you. Take a jump. And that jump will not be only a death, it will be a rebirth. But you cannot know that. Only death. You see only death. The beyond that is hidden behind the death, you cannot see. I can see it. I know you will be reborn. But nobody can be reborn unless one dies. So death is not the goal, and death is not the end, it is just a beginning. When you are ready to die, you are ready to be reborn. The old will disappear. An absolutely new will come in its place. That new is struggling from your very core of being. The old is struggling from the mind. Because mind has memory, the old, the past. The past and future are struggling within you. That is the problem. Now it depends on you. Whether you are being overpowered by the past, then you will delay, postpone. And you can delay it for many lives. And this is not for the first time that you have delayed. Many times you have missed before. Many times you have come across a Buddha, a Mahavir, a Jesus, you escaped. You tried to avoid. You closed your eyes. Again and again you have been playing that game. But the game is natural, I say to you, because you can see only death. The river can only see that sea will dissolve. Sea cannot see, sea will become the ocean. How can sea see? That oceanic existence will be only when the river is no more. So the river cannot see. When your ego is no more, only then you will know who you are. Don't allow the fear to overpower you. Allow love to overpower you. Love comes from the center, fear always from the periphery. Don't allow this periphery to be so dominant. And what you have got to lose? Even if there is no rebirth, there is rebirth, but I say even if there is no rebirth, you simply die, what have you got to lose? What will be lost? What the river has got that is worth preserving? The life through the hills has been just a struggle. The life through the plains has been just a dirty passage. What the river has got to lose in the ocean? Nothing. So think about it. What you have got to lose if you come closer? Your suffering, your madness, what have you got to lose? There is nothing to lose. But we never look within to see that we have got nothing to lose, because that too gives fear. So we like to think that much we have got to lose. A treasure is there. And you have never looked, there is no treasure. The house is empty. There has been never anything. But you are so afraid you never look, because you know that there is nothing. So even a beggar dreams that he is an emperor. In dreams he becomes an emperor. Enjoys. And then he is afraid if the kingdom is lost. But there has never been any kingdom. You have come to me because there has never been any kingdom. You have nothing to lose. And now you become afraid. See at the tricks of the mind, the deceptions of the mind. Look into them. A man entered a pet shop. He looked around and he asked the shopkeeper how much that big dog will cost. A very ferocious looking Alsatian. How much the dog will cost? The man said 500 rupees. That was too much for him. So logically, he said, and how much this small fellow will cost? Another dog of a smaller size. The man says 1,000 rupees. He tried still. Then he said, and how much this tiny one? A very small dog. The man said 2,000 rupees. The man became very much puzzled and disturbed. And then he asked, how much it will cost if I don't purchase anything? Because the rates are going higher. The dog is disappearing. And if I don't purchase anything, then how much it will cost? That is your fear. What will happen if you come closer to me? Nothing will happen, because you have nothing to lose. And everything will happen, because once this nothing is lost, everything becomes possible. Once this shelter, which has become a bondage to is lost, this sky opens infinitely. Once these banks, which have been a prison to you, are lost, you become boundless, you become infinite. Let the river move unafraid into the unknown, the uncharted. Death will be there, but death is always followed by rebirth. Die and reborn. Lose yourself and find. Fear comes from your mind. Love comes from your heart. Listen to the heart. It happened once in a great palace of a king. There was one musical organ. He loved it very much, but something has gone wrong. And the organ was so unique, nobody knew how to fix it. Nobody has ever seen it. This king also had heard when he was a very small child, when his father was alive. And since then, something had gone wrong. But he loved the organ so much that he used to keep it in his room. It was beautiful. Even from the outside it was beautiful. Many experts were called. In vain. They made many efforts and things became worse from that. the organ was more and more distired. The king lost his hope. The organ cannot be fixed. Then suddenly one day, one beggar appeared. To the doorkeeper he said, "I have heard that something has gone with the organ. I can fix it." The doorkeeper had the feeling to laugh, because great experts from many capitals of the world had come, great musicians. They couldn't find what is wrong. They couldn't even recognize what type of organ is this and what type of music is created by it. It was so complex. He had the feeling to laugh, but he looked at the beggar. The voice, the beggar's eyes seemed authentic. He was absolutely confident. He was a beggar, but his face looked majestic. The mind was saying that it will be again a wastage. But the heart said, "This man seems so confident. What is wrong if he tries?" So he took him to the king. Looking at the beggar, the king laughed and he said, "Are you mad? Every type of expert has tried and failed." "You must be mad. You think you can fix it?" The beggar said, "Nothing more. No more harm can be done. The organ is already out of order, absolutely. I cannot harm it anymore. So what is the harm if you give me a chance?" The king thought he was right, because nothing more harmful can be done. So he said, "Okay, you try." For many days, the beggar disappeared behind the organ. He was working and working and working. And suddenly one midnight, he started playing on the organ. The whole palace was filled with an unknown melody. Something so divine. Everybody ran. The king came out of his bedroom. He said, "You have done. It must have been very difficult. It was almost impossible. You have done a miracle." The man said, "No, it was not difficult, because in the first place I made it. In your father's time, I made this organ, so it was not difficult." "If you are ready, just for one thing, no more harm can be done to you. You are already harmed. I cannot harm you anymore, this much is certain. And look at my eyes and feel my voice. Give me a chance." "And it is not difficult, I say to you. Once one is dissolved into the infinite, he is at the source of the things from where you have come. I'm not there. If I was there, then it was difficult. There is no expert in me. The expert is dead long before. The ego is the expert. I don't know anything. I am not there. I have disappeared. The ocean exists. God exists, not I. In the first place, you are closer to something from where you have come. And for God, nothing is impossible, because in the first place, He created you. And I am not there, otherwise it would have been a very difficult thing. And if I am there, then I will harm you. Ego can only harm. Experts can only destroy. They cannot fix you. You have been with many experts. And they have done every type of form that was possible. Now you are beyond repair. But the river can fall in the ocean. And suddenly, the melody arises. A music will come out of you. A music that you have not heard. It is just hidden in you. Just the ego has to be put out of the way. I have heard what and so forth. But then the teacher recognized that one small boy, Johnny, has not answered. So he asked Johnny, "What do you do?" Johnny hesitated a moment and then he said, "Mostly I keep out of the way." You just keep yourself out of the way, that's all. Don't come in between me and you. Just keep out of the way. Even for a single moment, if you keep yourself out of the way, the thing would have happened. The old died, the new born. In a footnote.